Welcome to episode 26 of the Harry Potter Lexicon podcast. My name is Steve Vandrark, and I am the creator and editor-in-chief of the Harry Potter Lexicon website.
And I'm Nick Moline, the Lexicon's tech wizard.
That's right. And so we are here once again to chat about things going on in the world of Harry Potter. First off, before we start, we always chat a little bit about the site itself. Anything new? Nick, that's going to be on you. I mean, I can tell you about a lot of little stuff, but...
I mean, other than the army of people putting in new information from the next thing we're going to talk about.
Right.
Not visibly. We do have a couple of things coming down the pike, but...
Okay. Well, yeah, we won't talk about them until they come down the pike.
Yeah.
So, interesting, though, you know, some people might wonder how it is we go about getting all that new information in there. We're not, like the wiki has, like, I don't know, hundreds of people that all add information to that thing. We have about 10. And so we maintain a spreadsheet of all the new information that comes in all the different new sources, and all the editors kind of work their way through that spreadsheet, check off when they've got an entry finished. Many of those entries, if not all of them, actually, as soon as they are official, you know, on the list, the entries get created. They're just empty. So if you can actually go to them, and you're going to find nothing. And, you know, maybe send us a nice little email saying, hey, there was nothing there. Well, the reason is those entries have to be created. And so that, for example, I was just doing, working on the timeline for Tonks, okay? And the reason I'm working on the timeline is because we didn't have her, starting Hogwarts as an event in the lexicon. Because, you know, you think, well, you can't have everybody start in there. That'd just be a whole bunch of starts. You know, there'd be a lot of extra stuff that really isn't necessary on the timeline. Now, you could argue that that's all just necessary because it is on the timeline, part of the timeline. But so there were a bunch of those that didn't exist. Well, when I'm editing, I want to link to those things.
Right.
And I can't link to them if they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I wanted to link to an event which was Tonks getting killed, in the Battle of Hogwarts, and there is no specific event saying Tonks was killed in the Battle of Hogwarts, I can't link to it because it doesn't exist. So I have to make sure that all of those other entries also exist, even if I don't fill in all the information, just so I can create the links. And so all the things exist. You know, I think I've created every link for every single thing from all the new canon that's come along, and the editors now go through and they follow along and they add all the juicy bits, all the information, all the additional links, all the additional related entries, and all that kind of stuff. So that's what's going on right now. So there's new stuff, just, you know.
Yeah, editorial sort of new stuff.
That's right.
And where's this new stuff coming from? How about what's new?
Okay, okay. And as well you know, sir, there's a new edition of Fantastic Beasts just got published, which is
for anybody who's confused. The Fantastic Beasts school book that was originally released back in 2001.
Correct.
This is nothing directly related to do with the movie, other than the fact that that's probably why they got the idea to redo it.
Right. Yeah. So this is a new edition of the book that came out in March of 2001. And that's called, it's just Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Him. The author is supposedly Newt Scamander. And, so that's the big thing. New news since the last time we had a podcast. And so we're going to talk about that. We'll talk about Fantastic Beasts and Quidditch Through the Ages, which was the other little book that came out back in March of 2001.
I understand we're getting a new version of that, too, but it's coming out later in the year.
So here's my question for you.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
Not all of it. I'm up to N.
So you're actually reading the whole thing.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Oh well, I have to admit that I'm not reading the whole thing through since I've read it probably in the neighborhood of 40 or 50 times. So I don't feel like I need to read it again.
I will admit it has been a while. I used to use it as a reference book, right? I mean, I think I only read it through beginning to end once.
Yeah.
And then after that, I wanted to look up a particular creature or something like
exactly.
that, and I never really. Read it again the way I read the novels.
Sure.
Right.
Right. So, what are your thoughts on the new stuff, anyway?
Overall, I mean, it's the new stuff seems pretty is really enjoyable. I like getting. It feels connected. Is that a way to, does that make any sense?
Sure.
I mean, it's almost like it's different now that we have some idea who Newt Scamander is other than a name.
That is true. Yeah.
Right. And so with like the new foreword at the beginning, which is written by Newt Scamander rather than Dumbledore as it was in the original edition, you know, it feels personal, right? I mean, it feels, mm-hmm. okay, this is somebody we now can relate to, who we couldn't relate to before.
Sure, I can see that. We have, of course, behind the scenes, compiled a complete document with every change, you know, in there. And so I can go through and actually see the exact changes between the two. But I think what for most people is the most interesting is, well, the six new creatures, of course, and the intro by Newt Scamander himself, which, like you said, is now it feels very different because now we know who this character is. But I find it very... The new intro by Newt Scamander seems to me like, okay, now I'm gonna get a little bit downer here. And I guess this is based partly on because I have a totally different concept of what these books are for and where they fit into things. And this just seemed like just a little bit of a blurb for the film. So come see movie 2 because hint, hint, hint. That's a little bit of what it seemed like to me, which I guess I don't have a problem with that because that's part of the fun of being a Harry Potter fan all along has been speculating and looking for the clues. And the clues didn't always seem like they were going to hit us upside the head. But so that my feeling was it was a little bit less. You know, it's hard to describe. I guess once we start talking more about Quidditch Through the Ages and Fantastic Beasts in the context of 2001, it might become a little bit more solidified in my head of what I'm trying to say. I thought that the six new beasts were fine. Seems to me there should have been about 20 new beasts.
I agree. If you're going to go through the trouble of making a book,
there's so many that should be in there that are not. And to put those six in, and not even all, I mean, these were all American, which is kind of, there's a little backstory to that involved in the introduction, the idea that President Pickery did not want American magical beasts included in the original because she didn't want to encourage wizarding tourism.
Right.
That's the conceit there. But which is fine. But again, if you're going to include six, then you really should include more because Pukwudgie's not in there, for example. And that's
right.
One of the...
Where's Pukwudgie?
So it's like...
We all want to know what a Pukwudgie really is. Come on.
Well, okay. You could look it up in the lexicon, Nick. It is in there along with a very beautiful picture.
Yes, and we have the information as was from the History of Wizarding America thing that was published on...
Right, and we also have some good folklore that it's all based on, but...
Right.
But my point is that if you're going to have Thunderbird, if you're going to have, you know, Horned Serpent, if you're going to have the Wampus Cat, then you really should have had Pukwudgie as well.
If you got three, you need the fourth.
Yeah, that seems an odd omission to me. And just in general,
unless Pukwudgie is not classified as a beast.
Okay, we could go there because...
House
elves aren't in Fantastic Beasts.
Because
are centaurs?
Centaurs are because they specifically asked to be classified as a beast rather than a being.
Yeah.
Right? There's this whole thing in the introduction about beast versus being, right?
Sure.
And at least in the wizarding world, the definition of being is defined as a basic level of intelligence. Now, the Pukwudgie from the folklore story we got of the founding of Ilvermorny, he has conversations, right? So
sure, and I guess, yeah, you got a good point there, because a Pukwudgie would be like a house elf, and house elves aren't in there either, or neither are goblins, because they're not beasts. So, yeah, that's a good point. So, anyway, I guess my way of looking at it is, more than anything, is that you add six, and... we could just go off listing all sorts of other ones which should be in there, which are not. But I guess that's in some sense, it's like, you know, why complain when you get six? That's six more than you had, right?
Right.
So now, What about the Audible version? Is that the audio version? Is that out yet or not?
It is. I've been listening to it in the car. It's okay. So I've got one thing I really love about it, and another thing that's the exact same thing that I also really bugs me about it. All right.
Okay. All right.
So it's read by Eddie Redmayne, as we talked about previously. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He reads it exactly the way he plays Newt Scamander, which, frankly, is the way he plays every character he's ever played. But that's neither here nor there. But, you know, he reads it as Newt Scamander. Here's the problem. He starts right here at the beginning in the introduction, you know, starting the whole, in 2001, a reprint of the first edition of my book. He says that.
Okay. Why is that a problem?
Okay, so he's made it clear, that introduction makes it clear that this is being written now. That this new introduction is being written now, that this is a new release.
Okay.
And that Newt himself is writing this introduction, therefore he is alive. Right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, in 2017, I took note of, here we go. All right, so in 2017, he should be 120 years old.
Okay.
He sounds exactly the same way he did in 1926 at age 29.
Okay.
So, unless the third movie's going to show us him finding the Fountain of Youth, and he just lives at about 30 years old forever, it's a disconnect, right? So if you're going to go through the trouble,
so you want him to be saying things like, "Well, way back when I was a wee little whippersnapper, I used to be,"
or have it not be him. Maybe he's Rolf's dad. Do something, right?
Okay.
Maybe his son sounds exactly like he used to, or something like that.
Okay.
The problem is, by using Eddie Redmayne and not saying otherwise, and having him read all this stuff from first person and everything like that, it's very clear that he is supposed to be reading this to us as Newt.
Okay. I would say one thing I will say is that it doesn't mean that it's 2017.
It's sometime after 2001.
Correct. But it doesn't have to be 2017, which does not shoot down your point.
He'd still be at least 110 then. That's not helping much.
Right, but I just want to clarify that it, in actuality, we don't know exactly when this supposedly, all we know is that it was after 2001. Right. That's all I'm saying.
Since we've already started talking about this sort of stuff, save that other block for the end here. Let's just go into it. My other big thing, right, is you have the old one in front of you, right? I meant to go look for my copy, and I haven't done it yet. It's in a closet somewhere.
Okay.
Didn't we have an edition number in that? In its original introduction or something like that?
The 52nd edition.
Okay. There's an inconsistency here because this introduction says that in 2001, a reprint of the first edition of my book was made available to Muggle readers.
Let me see. What it says here is the first edition of Fantastic Beasts was commissioned back in 1918 by Mr. Augustus Worm of Obscurus Books, who was kind enough to ask me whether I would consider writing an authoritative compendium of magical creatures for his publishing house. Okay, that's in the introduction. I'm trying to find what you're talking about.
Okay, the very first sentence.
I was deeply honored when Newt Scamander asked me to write the foreword for this very special edition.
The very first sentence of the new version says, in 2001, a reprint of the first edition of my book. Right? That is the very first sentence in the introduction. In the new one.
Okay.
All right? The implication is the reason Rowling chose to say it that way is because that way they could explain away the lack of all the American creatures. right?
Okay, okay.
Because they can do the whole thing with Pickery and say the Pickery asked for it not to be there, blah, 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 blah. That all makes sense. But I could have sworn that the old one listed an edition number, and it wasn't the first.
Right.
And yep, you say 50 seconds, so I don't know.
Let's see. In the 2001 edition, it says, although almost solely responsible for the creation of the Werewolf Register in 1947, he says it's his... Mr. Scamander's work with the Dragon Research and Restraint Bureau led to many research trips abroad, during which he collected information for his worldwide bestseller, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, now in its 52nd edition. That was in 2001.
And that was in Dumbledore's introduction?
Yes.
So I guess he doesn't specifically say
that was no. That was in the About the Author.
About the Author.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess it doesn't specifically say that what we are looking at is the 52nd edition, just that it is in its 52nd edition. But it heavily implies it.
Right, and I offer this work as a mere introduction to the wealth of fantastic beasts that inhabit our world. 75 species are described in the following pages, but I do not doubt that at some time this year yet another will be discovered, necessitating a 53rd revised edition of the Fantastic Beast.
Okay, so
that was changed to another revised edition in the new version.
So that implies, that definitely implies that that was the 52nd edition.
Mm-hmm.
But the introduction of the new edition retcons that to say that what we got in 2001 was the first edition of the book.
Which retcons? Doesn't make it
retroactive continuity.
Thank you. All right.
Sorry, that's a term.
I know, but it doesn't mean everybody knows it. In fact, okay. I didn't. So okay. So here's the thing. We are going to have a problem with timeline because of this book. We know that because of some of the changes that were made to connect up to the film, there will probably be some timeline issues. Okay, and for example, in 2001, Dumbledore was not alive.
Yes, that's I've got that listed down here in the notes too.
Right.
So,
That I don't have a problem with that in terms of a 2001 edition of the book, because there's nothing to say that this project wasn't in the works for 5 years.
Except maybe.
Well, but you know what I mean is that there's no reason that I mean. The point is, you can come up with a, you know, it may seem a stretch, but you can come up with a reason, a logical reason. It's not like they said Dumbledore is alive in 2001. We have to assume
that again. The new version's opening paragraph heavily implies that,
but it doesn't say it. And we can work out some sort of logic, you know, strained as it may be, to suggest that, you know, that we can still fit that into his death in 1998.
I'm about to disprove this right now.
But my point is, it's going to be harder if they actually say that this is a reprint of the first edition.
Uh-huh.
Because the first edition was in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In 1929, there would not have been American creatures. And so that makes sense. The first edition of the book would not have American creatures back in 1929 when it was first published.
Yes, because of Pickery's request.
Because of Pickery's ban. Uh-huh. So, and it was only, you know, in 1927 that she even did the first, you know, protection order about Thunderbirds, which eventually covered all creatures. But we can easily imagine that the first edition of the book in 1929 had, you know,
I thought the first edition was 27.
I don't know. I don't have that in front of me.
Because in the movie, which is 1926,
mm-hmm.
he says.
Oh, I think you're right. I think it is 1927.
Right.
Okay. I'm quickly paging through this paper edition. It's kind of hard because the pages are almost falling out of this page's edition. Oh, yes. First published in 1927. But the point remains that the there's a perfectly logical reason that if they are reproducing the 1927 version, then, but see, I've always been of the impression and argued this for, you know, the last 15 years, that Fantastic, the book that we have is not the whole book, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. It is a heavily redacted version, heavily edited version, created for Muggle consumption. And so the actual book, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, would be much, much thicker and have much, much more information. And this is just a much trimmed down version created solely for the
Muggles.
You know, for the Muggles. If you look at Quidditch Through the Ages, for example, there is a property of Hogwarts School Library in the front which lists the due date for this book as all these people checked it out. And the due dates run right through July and August. Which would mean if this was an actual library book, there would be no due dates in July and August because the kids wouldn't be there to check it out.
Right.
And so the point is that this was obviously
also, why is it a library book?
It's obviously a created facsimile. Why would it not be a library book? Both of these would be.
Because it wasn't a library. It was one of his textbooks.
Quidditch wasn't. Quidditch was a library
Quidditch
book.
Quidditch was not. Okay, sorry. Quidditch
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Quidditch Through the Ages is and see, so when you look at that, clearly this is just something that somebody... You know, somebody on Dumbledore's staff, whoever was, you know, at Wizard Books, whoever was creating this Muggle version of Quidditch Through the Ages, was doing a heavy editing in order to make a sort of a souvenir version for the Muggles. And so they just made up this little, you know, nameplate for the front. That's the only explanation for why that would exist the way it does. And it makes sense, too. If you look at the size of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them in paper, the thing runs 42 pages. Well, I'm sorry, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them in World is a lot more than 42 pages. You know, so the point is that you have a heavily edited, you know, fake version created for Muggles. And once you've said that, well, you know, then all the dates and everything get kind of mushy in terms of when everything happened, because this was obviously something that was created over time. Didn't happen overnight. They didn't just take the actual book and just print it over again and make it available. So, you know, I can easily imagine that this was something that took a few years to put together. Especially
Except, if you think
about the years when it's happening, they were a little busy with other stuff.
So I've got my disproof here. So, okay, so it says, and it's still in that same paragraph. I was permitted to reissue the book only on condition the disclaimer was added, assuring Muggle readers that it is a work of fiction. Professor Albus Dumbledore agreed to provide a foreword that met the case, and we were both delighted the book raised so much money for some of the world's most vulnerable people.
Mm-hmm.
So, regardless of when it started, how is Dumbledore delighted that it raised money if he died before the book before it was released?
Oh, I think you know the answer to that.
You're trying to... I'm sorry, I don't think he would put down there... And Dumbledore's portrait was delighted.
I don't think he would put that down because it sounds a little weird, but I think that'd be exactly... Again, look, what I'm saying is we can come up with reasons, answers, explanations, even though they may be a little labored for that kind of stuff.
That's very labored.
Maybe it is, but there you go. What choice do you have? Because... Whenever we run into these things, on one hand, you just put them, like in the lexicon, we just put them in the commentary and leave it as is. We don't try to explain them away. But between you and me, and as we discuss this, if we don't look at it in terms of that can't be, but if we look at it in terms of but it is, and so therefore how? See, that's what we run into with a lot of these things. If you can just say, well, that can't be, it's an inconsistency, and you're right, that is correct. Okay, but... Since this is a fun parlor game, let's do it in terms of, well, let's just see if it really was, assuming that it is the fact. So then how did that work out? You see what I'm saying? You can look at it both ways, and neither one, I mean, both of them are perfectly valid ways to do it, which is why on the lexicon, we have a commentary section at the bottom of every entry, and when there are inconsistencies and things like this, we just list them down there. We don't try to explain them away. We just, you know, here's an inconsistency, make of it what you will. You know, and we'll put in fan theories. This is how come this is, or this is one way of explaining it, kind of a thing. So, yeah, there you go. Doesn't change what you said. I mean, you're absolutely right. That is an inconsistency. But it is not outside the realm of possibility to explain that one away. I mean, there are some things that you just get to the point where you're like, okay, I just cannot come up with one on this. But that one, at least we can come up with something.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems obvious. We've had a discussion about portraits before. Mm-hmm. It seems obvious that nobody thinks of the portraits as being the person.
I don't know. I know what you're saying, but the portraits in Dumbledore's office do get treated a lot more like actual people. Think about the one of Everard and Dillis Derwent who got sent on missions to find out about Arthur Weasley being hurt. Think about Phineas Nigelis's portrait and the way it was part of the story in Deathly Hallows. I mean, those particular portraits have a lot more life than most, I think.
And so does the fat lady, and even...
Yeah, the fat lady's pretty one-sided, but yeah, she goes off and drinking with Vi, and the two of them get drunk, and, you know, so...
But they're not the person. And in fact, you know, in the other book that some people are not wanting to choose to be canon, that we've talked about ad nauseum, there's even a statement of saying that I'm, you know... So, you know, Harry asks Dumbledore's portrait something, and Dumbledore answers something. I'm mere memory and pigment, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, at least in that book, it seems clear that the portraits don't consider themselves to be the person.
Well, the point remains. I mean, that's one way of at least making some sense out of it. I mean, nothing is going to be perfect because it is an inconsistency, but there is a way to explain it. So anyway, audio version is available.
Yes.
And Eddie Redmayne, even though you don't think he sounds old enough, does he do a credible job of, I mean, is it fun to listen to?
Yeah, sure. You want to hear a little bit?
You got it? Yeah. Play a little bit.
All right, hold on a second.
More intelligent than the fairy, and less malicious than the imp, the pixie, or the doxy, the leprechaun is nevertheless mischievous. Found only in Ireland, it achieves a height of up to 6 inches and is green in colour. It has been known to create crude clothing from leaves. Alone of the little people, leprechauns can speak, though they have never requested reclassification as beings. The leprechaun...
So there's that thing about reclassification as beings there, actually.
Right. So, okay, was there, like, little voices in the background of that?
Yes, there is background noise. It some places it's more apparent than others. Like, what's the creature... Let me search for this. The creature that never makes a sound until it's about to die?
A fooper.
Yeah, so, like, in that part, as soon as he says that, there's this, like, loud, clamoring noise.
Okay. Well, that's cool. But yeah. I would love to listen to that. I'll have to get a at some point or other, I'll have to get a copy of that, because I would love to listen to the whole thing through, just to kind of hear how they do it. And I didn't even realize that there was the additional sounds and things. So
there is. The sounds add something. And he does, because you know there's all these footnotes, right? And
yes.
They put the footnotes in line.
Oh, okay. So he'll pause and say the footnote.
He'll say note and then do something else. But he, like, changes his voice a little bit every time he's giving a footnote.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of interesting. Or if he's quoting somebody in those few places where he's, like, quoting from another book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he'll change his voice a little bit. It's still him, but he's definitely changing his voice. He definitely put a lot of work into it.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and clearly, really cool. I was wrong. Clearly, I'm an L. I thought it was an N for some reason, but if I'm at Leprechaun, I'm clearly an L.
That's all right. It doesn't matter to me which letter you're in. That's just really interesting to hear, though. Okay, I'm going to have to definitely get a hold of that, because it's going to be fun to listen to. So he includes all of that intro stuff, the information about the history and stuff.
And that was, and therein lies my problem, because right at the moment he mentions, in 2001 I did this, then I had the problem, right?
Okay, but my point... My point being that he talks through that whole opening conversations about beasts and beings and all that stuff.
Yes,
that's all included.
All of it. And that all sounds great.
Okay.
So the introduction stuff sounds great. Mm-hmm. It's just that, yeah, if they had left out that forward, then I wouldn't uh-huh. have a problem. But the uh-huh. fact that, yeah, of course, then I would say, oh, but this whole piece is missing, and this is where like half of the new canon is.
Sure. Okay. So, let's talk about we're well on our way down this rabbit hole. So let's keep going with it. I think looking at it's very important. Fandom-wise, to just think about these books, because I think a lot of people nowadays, a lot of fans nowadays, either haven't ever read these or just sort of dismiss them, maybe read parts of them, maybe use them as, like you say, to look things up. But I think the books came out March of 2001, and at that point, they were incredibly important. And let me talk a little bit about why. First of all, this was after Goblet of Fire, and Rowling had written one book per year, 1, 2, 3, 4, and book
and
four...
suddenly she stopped.
And the reason was is she had finally realized that she could simply not keep up this pace and do the good job, because she had run into huge plot problems in book four, and she felt like it was simply because she had been trying so hard to keep to her self inflicted schedule of one per year. That was what she had decided originally she was going to do. And so she kind of stopped after book four. And a lot of things happened between book four and book five. One of the things that happened was that she signed deals with Warner Brothers for the films. She was working with artists on a basic look for the characters and for, you know, because now there's going to be all this promotional stuff, toys, puzzles, blah, 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 blah. And so she spent, she just basically got turned it into the business empire that it is now.
Right.
And she did it with a lot of care, and it took a lot of time. And that was happening at the same time as she was writing book five.
And I do want to say one thing I've always thought about her is she managed to do it better than any author I have ever seen.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean,
I have
never seen an author sell their rights to a movie studio and still manage to maintain such an immense level of control the
right.
entire time.
Right. Her attitude was that I don't need this. You need me. I don't need you. And not in a mean way, but that was the truth. And that you're going to do it the way that I want, or we don't need to do this. It's not like I'm just dying to have this movie deal. And I guess I'm putting words into her mouth. I wasn't there. But that's the impression I get, is that her attitude was, I will sign this, but it's going to have to be done on my terms. Now, some fans believe, incorrectly, that she had complete control over the films, which she
right.
certainly did not. She
no.
has complete control over Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, but she did not have complete control over the films and did not want to have complete control over the films. She did
and,
have...
And that's the big deal. Even what control she did have, for the films themselves, she did not didn't really exercise what
not,
control
not,
she did.
Not nearly as much as people think, and not nearly as much as some of us wish she had.
Right.
But, you know, that's beside the point. Her attitude was... They make films, they're good at it, hire the right people, and then get out of the way, let them do their job, let them make the film. And we've talked about that before, too. And basically, during that time, she was making all of these, putting the pieces together to create the Harry Potter empire, if you will. And at that time, one of the things that she did as kind of a, okay, well, this will hold you over, is... wrote Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and Quidditch Through the Ages, these two small books. Now, the point that I'm making here is that these books are more than just some little Pottermore essay.
Right.
They are vastly different.
Fair.
The stuff that comes out now from Pottermore is like just minuscule compared to what's in these books. Because what she did is she almost... took her box of notes, which we have for the last 20 years been dying to see, and basically turned vast sections of those notes into these books. And I'm not just talking about the Quidditch stuff. I'm not just talking about animal stuff, beast stuff. I'm talking about her notes about her world. Mm-hmm. Because what happened in what happens in these books is that you get this beautiful, rich picture of the Wizarding World from about 1000 AD through the present. Before that, too, a little bit, but really most of it was started with about 1000 AD, which is right around when Hogwarts started and when Quidditch started. Now, what we have here is people think, oh, it's just about Quidditch. But if you read it, you get history. You get the history of the government and the of the Wizarding World, starting with the Wizards Council and going all the way through the changeover with this Statute of Secrecy. But you can see, if you're reading this book, you'll see the changes over the years and how the wizards' attitudes change and how the Statute of Secrecy, you can see it becoming necessary as you look at what goes on in the history of Quidditch and in the history of beasts and taking them seriously and then deciding that you have to try to control them and keep them hidden. And all of this comes from these books. So much of what we really know about the world of Harry Potter, the Wizarding World, is not just this surface stuff that you see if you go to the theme park. It's not just the surface stuff you read about if you read the novels. It's all this depth, and that depth came out in these two books. And people, I think a lot of fans either haven't read them or barely read them and are missing so much information and so much of the basis of the Wizarding World that just absolutely informs the stories in the books and now in Fantastic Beasts, the film. All of that is so much of what the attitudes and the way people treat each other and treat creatures and treat lesser quote unquote beings all comes from all of this rich history of the past 1 to 2,000 years. And none of that is, or very little of that, is anywhere except for in these two 42-page books.
Yeah.
And that plus, okay, that plus the famous wizard cards, because those also came out at the same time. And so that really is what these books are. And I think a lot of people, a lot of fans, have missed all of that.
It's amazing that these are the two books. You know, I mean...
Yeah, not Hogwarts of History.
Not Hogwarts of History.
Not History of Magic. Right.
We're given a history of magic from these two very vastly different perspectives. A perspective of sports and a perspective of, you know, a zoologist.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And because we had such vastly different perspectives between the two of them, I almost, like you say, we get so much richness from this. I have a hard time believing that if we had gotten a history of magic from Bathilda Bagshot, just based on the characterization of Bathilda Bagshot, you know, and what we get from the history of magic classes, I doubt we would have felt the richness. Even though there might have been more details, it would not have felt organic.
That's true. That's a really good way of looking at it. Because it is tied in with something which is so much an integral part of the wizarding culture, especially the Quidditch one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because if it would have just been history of magic, it would have, I mean, granted, Professor Binns is unusually boring for something talking about something as exciting as Goblin Wars. But if you think about it, yeah, to see people like the kid that you know complains about the boy, the freckle-faced 6-year-old who was all upset because they created the stooging penalty, which meant that you can only have one. I think that's the one where you can only have one chaser in the circle in front of the hoops at a time instead of being able to gang up on him with all the chasers.
Right.
And here's what it says. This is actually from the Daily Prophet in June 22, 1884. He says, "One freckle-faced six-year-old left the hall in tears. 'I loved stooging,' he sobbed to the Daily Prophet. 'Me and me dad like watching them keepers flattened. I don't want to go to Quidditch no more.'" Okay, it's just, this is okay, for one thing, it's vintage, absolutely classic rolling. But, I mean, that's just, that kind of, that's the kind of history that's,
and,
like
you
say,
know
organic, it's, and fun and wonderful.
And it's believable, too.
Yeah.
Because if you just look at, I mean, there's a, here in the United States, you know, there's this movement right now to change American football.
Right.
To, because, you know, there's all this evidence mounting that people are getting very seriously long-term injured from, you know, the danger of concussions and stuff
right.
like that. And naturally, people fight, you know, the idea is to essentially outlaw tackle football.
Right.
And by the way, this has happened before. You know, there was, you know, what was it? I think it was, you know, 50 years ago, there was this whole thing about trying to ban tackle football, and people rose up in arms against it
mm-hmm.
because that, you know, exactly like that. I love watching them get flattened. I mean, it's
right.
It sounds silly in a post flattening world, but when you're
right.
in the existing flattening world, it sounds,
yeah.
how could you fundamentally change something that I love?
Sure.
And
it kind of reminds me, in Quidditch Through the Ages, there's that quote about the Scottish game that I can't pronounce, you know, Creol Siam or whatever it's called, that it's basically dropping a whole bunch of rocks from high up, and then they all fly around with helmets on their heads and get hit by the rocks.
Right.
And it says here, it was enjoyed considerable popularity in the Middle Ages, despite the huge number of fatalities that resulted from it. The game was made illegal in 1762. And though Magnus Denthead MacDonald spearheaded a campaign for its reintroduction in the 1960s, the Ministry of Magic refused to lift the ban. I mean, it's like, this is good stuff, okay? And it's like you're saying, it's like we're seeing it through the eyes of real people.
Yes.
Yeah. And which is her, you know, just absolutely her gift of bringing us into those moments and into that stuff and just... I mean, just the whole idea of the story of the introduction of the Golden Snitch, for example.
Mm-hmm. The Snitch.
You know, is such a such a great little story in this poor little bird, and you know, Modesty Rabnot, who you know steps in and tries to stop them, and you know gets fined for what is it? She gets fined for, how does that go again? Oh, she says. Oh, yeah, she says, she writes in a letter afterwards, "Well, they caught me, but not before I'd got out of the crowds and released the Snidget. Chief Bragg was very angry, and for a moment I had thought I'd end up a horned toad or worse, but luckily his advisors calmed him down, and I was only fined 10 galleons for disrupting the game." Of course, I've never had 10 galleons in my life, so that's the old home gone. It's just great stuff. Which, by the way, that's all, if you haven't read that, you really need to read Chapter 4 of Quidditch Through the Ages. Actually, you have to read the whole thing, but... You know, but if you,
I just had this crazy thought as you were reading that thing. It's like, I was thinking, I wonder who they'll get to read Quidditch Through the Ages when that new version comes out.
I volunteer. That'd be awesome. I'd love to do that.
You want to do an audiobook?
But, yeah, we could do an audiobook of Quidditch Through the Ages. But the point of it is, I love your idea that saying that it's organic. It's a history of magic told through the eyes of common people, through the things that they love the most. And I guess, in some ways, Fantastic Beasts could be seen the same way, although everybody doesn't love creatures the way that Newt Scamander does, but we are reading about them through his eyes
yes.
and through his voice, as, if you've got the audiobook. And, of course, again, same exact thing. In the original edition, there are little, you know, handwritten graffiti in the book, which supposedly was written by Harry and Ron,
mm-hmm.
you know, the glum bumble, they circle the word the bum in the middle with a little arrow, that kind of stuff, typical schoolboy junk, you know. But again, these books, kind of looping back, are a lot more important to the world of Harry Potter than I think a lot of people realize. And the movie is not that.
No.
In the same way. It is, because it's important in its own way, because it's part of the history. It's telling us the story of Grindelwald and all this kind of thing. I don't mean
and
that it's not important, but I'm saying it's not as not important in the same way.
No. But from the same token, it turns around and adds, like I said at the beginning of this, adds a layer to this book that I didn't think was there before.
And I don't think it was.
And so it's interesting that that movie, which had really, believe it or not, nothing to do with Fantastic Beasts. They were there, but
right.
That's not what the movie was about.
No.
And
some would even say that it was a distraction from the actual plot.
Right. Some people have said that.
Yeah. Well,
but,
those people are clearly not fans, but okay.
Yeah, because I love that stuff.
I don't care. It's like we're always saying, no, you go right ahead, make it a 10-hour movie. We'll just watch.
We'll watch every bit of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Still waiting for the BBC miniseries of, you know, the suit. But no, you're right. You're right. It's the story of Grindelwald ties into the story of Newt Scamander in a very, very interesting way. And, of course, all the hints that are given in that introduction, the idea that, you know, some people said I was a spy for Dumbledore. Well, the people who say that are us fans. We've been saying that ever since we saw the movie. You know, so it's really interesting that she's kind of coyly saying, you know, huh, some people were saying that. I'll be darned. So, and the whole idea of, you know, Dumbledore's sister being the Obscurial. Yeah, I think all of that stuff is hinted at strongly in this book, and it makes a nice little layer on top. But I think what I hope people come away with is not, oh yeah, it's just a list of Fantastic Beasts. Because the second part is, but so many of those little, even those little blurbs, have little interesting little tidbits in them. Like, you know, the whole thing of the dragon attack on, you know, the Ilfracombe Beach. You know, that's actually now turned up in several other places, that whole story. And the fella who the Lethifold attack.
Mm-hmm.
The one who survived the Lethifold attack, I thought, is, you know, those kinds of things. Those are really, really interesting. And they have that same feeling of being real people and their story, you know, dealing with these beasts. So,
yeah.
Definitely. Now, I understand the new edition does not have the graffiti in it.
No.
That's unfortunate.
At least,
and
not,
it does.
At least not the digital version.
No. And I've looked through, and it has some beautiful artwork.
Yes. Gorgeous.
So I think that's pretty cool. I always like artwork. It's not canon, but there you go. The pictures in the original were drawn by a Rowling, so those would be canon. So
yeah, she didn't draw the Sacramentula, I don't know.
So sadly we've lost a little canon along the way. So, but what we have, there are lots of little details that we can pull out of these books, and some of them are just in passing, but they make you go, "Oh, what?" For example, that Daily Prophet article that I read was from 1884. So we know that the Daily Prophet's been published for at least, you know, 130 years, 120 mm-hmm. years. So, you know, and probably longer than that. But that's a tiny little detail. But we can pull that kind of stuff out of there. Interesting, the history of Quidditch. There's that one part where Goodwin Kneen writes a letter to his cousin, I think, and in that he says something about his... Here's a quote. "How are you? I am well, though Gunhulda has got a touch of dragonpox. We enjoyed a spirited game of Quidditch, spelled K-W-I-D-D-I-T-C-H, last Saturday night, though poor Gunhulda was not up to playing catcher, and we had to use Rodolph the Blacksmith instead." So, wait a minute. If she had dragonpox... We know from, I think, Pottermore, that dragonpox was originally contracted from contact with Peruvian viper-toothed dragons in, well, I assume Peru. And if they got if they got it from Peruvian viper-toothed dragons in Peru, and somebody in England had a case of it in the 1100s, that would certainly suggest that in the 1100s, wizard people had had contact across the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, you know, there was a, in the history of magic in North America thing.
Yeah.
There was a statement in there that wizards knew about America long before Muggles did.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So this would certainly suggest that wizards were making forays across to South America and dealing with Peruvian dragons back in the first millennia.
Yeah, the statement was that they had better forms of communication, so they were able to communicate across the void. So,
well, communicate across and apparently travel as well, because you can't communicate dragonpox.
Yeah, that way. They would have to have gotten some.
But I guess the point I'm making is that it's just very, very interesting to kind of put those facts together. And you could say, well, you know, Rowling wasn't thinking about the one fact when she wrote the other. And that may be true. It may be an inconsistency. But just like with everything else, let's take it at face value. Okay, so then what does that mean?
Another simple possibility is that the dragon wasn't named until later, and that it wasn't always from Peru, that's just died off elsewhere.
That could be, too. Could also be the fact that, I mean, when you think about what I just read, how are you? I am well, though Gunhilda has a touch of dragonpox. This would have been written in Old English.
Right.
And this sort of tongue-in-cheek kind of style, could they really have translated that? Was it really written in that kind of casual vernacular if it was in Old English? Or has it been sort of modernized for, you know, in the translation? Is it more of a, less of a translation and more of a, I don't know what you would call it, more of a version or abridged or a, I don't know. I can't even think of the word that I'm looking for. But, you know, an approximation kind of made into modern English. And then maybe when it said Gunhilda had a touch of, and then they don't know what that Old English word referred to, and so they had to make a guess. Well, we'll call it dragonpox because, you know, it's some sort of disease, and that's what our... If you read the Harry Potter universe, it seems like dragonpox is like the only serious disease anybody ever gets. You know, there's a couple of other ones, but they don't get nearly the play that dragonpox gets. So that would be possible, too.
I just noticed something really interesting about the book.
What's that?
Some creatures were taken out.
Does it say that in the...
No, I just found an instance of a creature that isn't there anymore, but definitely was in the original version.
Which one?
Thestrals. There's nothing here for Thestral.
Look up winged horses.
Is it under W?
It's under winged horse. He says without even having to look it up. Boom.
Why wouldn't it show up in search then? Search doesn't work.
Darn you,
Google.
Are you looking at it on Google Play? Google Books? Oh, okay. Well, no, it's under winged horse. It's under winged horse. It's in there. At least it is in the old one. So
yeah, it's still there in the new one. It's just that search wasn't working.
Winged horses exist worldwide. There are many different breeds, including the Abraxan. That's the one that the Beauxbatons carriage is pulled by.
Right.
And the rare Thestral, black, possessed with the power of invisibility, and considered unlucky by many wizards. Now notice, when this book was written, she was also writing book 5, which was when we were introduced to Thestrals. So, interesting. Because you got to remember that these books were written concurrent with book 5. And when you look at book 5, it's amazing how many things which we now just assume and don't even think about, they're just part of the Harry Potter universe, were brand new in book 5. And I'm not just talking about a visit to the Ministry of Magic, because that was a lot of new information about the Ministry. Which, incidentally, a lot of new information about the Ministry also in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and in Quidditch Through the Ages, especially in the footnotes. So you learn a lot about the structure of the Ministry of Magic from that stuff as well.
And the International Confederation of Wizards.
Exactly,
Lots of what we know about the ICW comes mm-hmm. from this book. I mean,
right. And so that a lot of that was in there. But a lot of, for example, in it wasn't until book five that we found out that the portraits in the headmaster's office didn't just sleep all the time. We made it all the way to book five. And we didn't learn about apparition until book four. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that is just seems so integral to the world that we didn't learn about until, quite far into the series.
Yeah, and she points to Fantastic Beasts as proof that she was thinking of these things beforehand, because mm-hmm. there was the Thestral thing. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. why I thought about it, and I was looking at her tea, and I couldn't find it, and mm-hmm. then I searched for it, and I couldn't find it. But,
right.
That's just a search problem.
Yeah, no, she, and so it's very interesting because a lot of, figure how much information about this world she brought out in these two little tiny, there's 84 pages, that's it, 84 pages. So I guess now when I see like these Hogwarts books that they came out with from Pottermore, I think, you know, those are kind of similar, but not nearly as rich, not nearly as much, you know, completely unknown. I mean, some, you know, lore about a particular character and so background of a character, and that's great. But just in terms of deep understanding of the wizarding world, I mean, I would love to see, you know, I want to know all about these goblin wars. I mean, she's got so many things, hints and everything in there about personalities and things like this, and the ministers of magic at the time, and all these things are in there, and they're in the Daily Prophets, and there's hints in Fantastic Beasts and Quidditch Through the Ages. So much of this information is there, just below the surface. We can't quite get our hands on it, and I would love it.
Isn't it great? You know, on the one hand, it's great. On the other hand, it's frustrating. I mean, as people working on the lexicon, we just want to ask Rowling to give us lists, right? But at the same time, isn't it better getting things this way?
I mean, definitely. Oh, definitely. It's in some ways, yeah, we've got Fantastic Beasts. We've got all these new beasts, and we can make an entry for each one. But, you know, that's not the fun part. The fun part is all the lore that comes along with it. The fact that, you know, a dragon carried off a hippogriff at one point, or these kinds of things, or it wasn't a hippogriff, it was a hippocampus. But the point being that that's really the fun part. Yeah, you can rattle off a bunch of names, and we can write those down, and okay, yeah, you've got your flabberworms, and you got your foopers, and all this stuff, but it's the lore that's really fascinating. And part of the fascinating part is working out, oh, then that means this, and oh, okay, so then that's part of this, and, you know, I don't really... It's perfectly fine with me if she doesn't just make a whole list of all this stuff. That would kind of take all the fun out of, you know, out of it. And would kind of take away the need for the lexicon at that point. But not entirely, because, you know, interesting that comes up. But
yeah, I know.
The lexicon, if all it was a list of facts, it would be of, you know, relatively limited use. And so that's why if you look at the lexicon, there's so much more. And it's part of its connections. And part of it is this commentary section at the bottom where you've got everything from etymologies of words to quotes from interviews that Rowling did that pertain to that entry. And there's so much information that we can add as fans who have been researching this stuff. I mean, for me, I'm closing in on 20 years that I've been doing this. And just gathering this information and just have a way to put that information out there for fans is really cool.
Yeah.
Because that's not the kind of stuff that you find on Pottermore. That's not the kind of stuff that you find in the wiki. This is the kind of thing that we are uniquely suited to do, I think.
I totally agree. I mean, that's
why... I'm glad.
I mean, that's part of what drew me to the lexicon in the first place, way back when, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was more less of a list and more of a making connections and pulling things together and making jumping to conclusions, if you will, making assumptions, but the ones that are very well grounded in canon to say, well, that means that if you enter the great hall, you must enter from one side and not from the middle and the back. Because if you read the text, when somebody does that, it says right in the text that they pass
all four tables.
Yeah. Which, if you came in the middle, you wouldn't pass the two outside ones. You'd only go walking down the middle between the two, you know, center ones. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that some people think, okay, you're just really getting carried away. But that's the fun of it.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't be so much fun if Rowling didn't have it so clearly in her own mind that when she writes this stuff, you can actually tease out those details, and that's what it is. If you look at, here's an example I use when I talk and I give talks on this. I have a map that I drew in 2001 of Hogwarts and everything around it, Quidditch pitch, Hagrid's hut, all that kind of thing. And I drew that map in 2001. There was no map. There did not exist a map at that time. Rowling had never drawn one. There was not a map. In fact, every question that came, it was put off. Like, no, there's no map and this kind of thing. Use your imagination kind of a thing. So I made this based on the text of the books. Well, after I made that map, a couple of years later, when the DVD of Prisoner of Azkaban came out, on that DVD, there was an interview with Rowling and the guy who directed it, and basically she held up a sketch map she had done for the filmmakers. Okay, this sketch map matches the one that I had done in 2001 almost exactly. And it isn't because I'm so clever. It's because in her mind, when she was writing about people walking around on the grounds, she could see it in her mind of where they were.
Yep.
And it came through in the text. And see, that's what makes it so fascinating to do what we do. And honestly, that's why when people say, oh, you can't go outside of just what's in the actual books. Yeah, you kind of can with her. Because she has all this extra information, and she just has never had a chance to a place to put it. But when she writes and when she talks, she's got this world in her head. And man, I'll tell you, these books, it's amazing. They just lay out this rich, as I keep putting it, this rich tapestry of the world of Harry Potter from, you know, for the last 2,000 years, especially the last 1,000 years, it's all there in all of its richness. And as you said, through the eyes of the real people that lived it. Sounds like a real thing here, doesn't it? And so if you're a Harry Potter fan and you've never read these books, or if you kind of read them once and you've forgotten all about it, boy, you owe yourself another look.
Absolutely.
Yeah, pick up a copy of the new one if you can't find your old ones, of the new Fantastic Beasts. Oh, and while you're at it, if you're going to pick up a new copy, use the link that we have in our show notes, or go to our support page and use the Amazon link from there to order it, so that we actually get a little bit of support coming back at us. Because that's important. We are trying so hard not to have to put advertising on the site. And
we live in fear of doing that.
And I see it coming. Sadly, I really do. And I do not want to have to do that. And so we're really want to encourage people to support the Lexicon. It doesn't have to be a lot. It doesn't actually have to cost you anything. If you go to, if you want to go to Patreon, you can go on there, become a subscriber. Remember that we are going to be doing a drawing at the end of April for everybody who is signed up as a Patreon supporter up through the month of March. We're going to be doing a drawing for that beautiful necklace that we talked about last time from King Ice. It's a beautiful key necklace. And we'll talk more about that online. There's going to be a blog post coming up with a lot more information and some pictures and things. And so that's a great way to do it. And that's good because that's a kind of an ongoing support. For every dollar that you pledge on Patreon, you get one entry into the contest. So if you want to go for a galleon, which is about $6 now, you get six entries into the contest. So by all means, please consider that.
$6.14.
Thank you. Yes, I knew it was somewhere on the homepage.
Yeah.
But you can also just go to Amazon through the link on our support page and just do your regular buying on Amazon that you do. And if you start your session from the link on our support page, then some small percentage of anything that you buy goes back to the Lexicon website. So that's another great way to do it. That actually doesn't cost you anything. If you're ordering anyway, just do that. And, of course, there's always Loot Crate. Nick, I'm going to have you talk about Loot Crate because I do not have first-hand experience with this, and you do, so go for it.
So Loot Crate, I got my shipping notification today, actually, that the March Wizarding World crate, the one that is Hogwarts House Pride as the theme, has been shipped. So probably our next podcast is going to be another unboxing.
So if it has been shipped, how long does it take to actually arrive?
According to FedEx, it'll get here on Friday.
Okay.
So this weekend, okay. I'll be doing another unboxing.
Okay. So we're going to we'll have to set up another another video podcast then in order to take a look at that. So that's good, and I can sit here and drool over all the cool stuff that you'll be getting. So the reason we're bringing that up is because why?
Because if you subscribe to Loot Crate has a Wizarding World crate. Every crate contains unique and themed items for the Wizarding World. And so it's a bi-monthly crate. So if you subscribe now, you'll get the May crate. So the next crate will come in May. And the next one's themed is the Dark Arts, I believe.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wrote a blog post about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... and so everything will be interestingly dark in the next one, I imagine.
Or very pink.
Or very pink.
Good God, I think I put something in the blog post about just praying that it's not, you know, the frolicsome feline plates. I don't know if I could handle that. Of course, I'm not going to have it, but I don't even know if I could handle having it on your wall.
It'll go right here next to my
Can you
Ravenclaw
imagine?
Banner.
Can you imagine? Oh my gosh, that would be just anything more sickening.
So if you like sickening plates,
if you like things a little dark once in a while,
yeah, mm-hmm. then oh. you should sign up for the next Wizarding World.
Yeah,
crate.
Definitely. And again. Go
or any of Loot Crate's other crates. They've you know their main crate is fun. It has different things every month.
From all different sorts of sci-fi fantasy media stuff.
Yeah, and okay. but so if you subscribe to Loot Crate using our link and our code, so it's lootcrate.com/hplexicon and use promo code hplexicon.
Uh-huh.
It's all one word, no hyphens or anything like that.
Sure.
Then you get a discount, which is great for you,
uh-huh.
and we get some money, which is great for the lexicon and keeping it up.
And so, you get a cool Loot Crate.
And you get a cool Loot Crate.
My son gets the Firefly one, so that's the first. That's where I was introduced to the whole Loot Crate thing.
I've never watched Firefly.
Oh.
I refuse to watch Firefly.
Okay, let's not go there.
it's because everybody loves it, and I know if I watch it, I'll love it too. And
yes,
then
you will.
I'll just get pissed off that there's only 13 episodes.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
So I have held off this long.
Okay. Well, okay, we've talked about support. We got to wrap this thing up. We're running, as our usual, we're running a little over an hour, I believe. Yeah, we're hour 10, so that's all right. Whatever. But here's the point.
We've done worse.
We want to wrap it up. That's about it for episode 26. Once again, we want to give a big shout-out to Harry and the Potters, who let us use the music that we use at the beginning and the end of the podcast. Check out the Lexicon website. I'm assuming you all know about it, or you probably wouldn't be listening to this podcast. But just in case, www.hp-lexicon.org, just to see how the richness of Rowling's created world kind of translates over into our website. And then I like to things that kind of caught our eye, and I don't know if you've got anything, Nick, but one thing I wanted to mention. We have an editor named Kathy McCabe who has been doing a fantastic job with our Facebook page and our Twitter feed for the Lexicon. And I don't think I've mentioned those recently anyway. And so if you get a chance to go on Facebook and look up the Facebook page, it's, you know, and now I have to look up the Facebook page because I can't remember if it's HP Lexicon or Harry Potter Lexicon.
I'll
put a link in the show notes. No, it's the Harry, it's called Harry Potter Lexicon, all one word, Harry Potter Lexicon. So if you go to Facebook, search for Harry, or just search for the Harry Potter Lexicon, you'll find it. And that is, it's a lot of fun to follow because she just puts so many cool links on there of just really interesting stuff, and not all from the lexicon, just stuff that's cool fan information, stuff that's going on in the world of Harry Potter fandom. Even stuff about J.K. Rowling. She posted something from Goodreads, which is J.K. Rowling sends fans on a hilarious hunt for the new Cormoran Strike book title. So, I mean, just lots of things. Beautiful stuff on there. She's just really, really good at finding cool tidbits to throw on there, and also on Twitter. So if you get a chance, by all means, check those things out, because I think you'll really enjoy following those if you like having that kind of stuff in your feed. So I guess that's the thing that I kind of wanted to make sure I've been thinking about lately. Patreon giveaway. And yes, go. Yeah.
So for me, it's a bit of a cop-out, but the thing that caught me is from this very book so that we've been reading, because that's fresh on my mind. And I was really struck in this new, you know, of course, the big thing for me is the new foreword. The new creatures are all great, except they're all creatures we already knew something about. So,
True.
So it's not like it was a huge deal for me. It's great to have the extra details, but for me, this whole opening thing, you know, just gets me more excited about, you know, this continuing movie franchise and what the next movie is going to be. You know, this whole statement. Where is it here? It's
Should I be talking to cover the gap in here as you're looking?
Sorry. Oh, actually, more I can't
say. Because you did that, and I'll just throw in here, the if you read the description of the Hide Behind, the origin is a little disturbing.
The origin of the Hide Behind is very disturbing.
It is.
I was listening to that on the way to work this morning.
Okay, anyway, go ahead. What
all right,
were you going to say?
You know, when he's saying, it's also true that Albus Dumbledore was something more than a school teacher to me. More than this, I cannot say without fear of breaching the Official Magic Secrets Act. Where's that statement where he says that he'll say more as more details come out?
Well, that must be somewhere in there if you remember it, unless you dreamed it. But
you know, he makes a statement in this opening thing, and I'll find it, but. he makes a statement that, you know, there's stuff that he can't say about the encounter with Grindelwald yet. Here we go. As more documents become declassified over the coming years, I will be freer to speak openly about my role during that dark period in our history. That's the statement. And so, you know, it just kind of that one sentence there in this opening thing just kind of reaffirmed how excited I am for it's like I'm ready for the next movie already.
Yeah, so. Definitely. As if I wasn't anyway, but
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, absolutely. So, you got a question for the question of the day as we roll out of here?
Yeah, so I think for the question of the day, I just want to go back to the thing that bugged me the most and and I'll ask our listeners, did Dumbledore's portrait write the foreword? Or did the foreword get written before Dumbledore died? And can a portrait be delighted? Because I don't think a portrait can be delighted.
I don't know. I've got an answer to that, but
okay. Either say it or put it in the comments.
I'm just going to say read the last chapter, not the epilogue. Read the last chapter of Deathly Hallows, and you'll see a whole bunch of delighted portraits. Okay, so let's just leave it at that.
Portraits,
okay,
but
excited. Oh, Dillis Derwent is weeping uncontrollably. That's beyond excited. So, anyway, that about wraps it up for now. We are going to roll out of here, and we'll do another podcast soon, especially if there's a loot crate to play with. But that about takes care of this one. This is Steve Vanderark of the Harry Potter Lexicon.
And Nick Moline, the Tech Wizard.
And thanks for listening.